From WUWM FM and HD1 Milwaukee, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Bonnie North. MPS students again have some of the lowest math and reading scores in the nation. News analyst Bruce Murphy weighs in on that, plus teacher union recertifications. Then informed consent in medicine and the vast gray area when it comes to scientists using a patient's blood samples in research.
There's no requirement, anonymous or not, about telling people their tissues may become profitable and that someone may make products using them or develop things that would become patented that would become valuable.
A Milwaukee author sets her debut novel in an import shop, and an interactive children's book application for the iPad that's a marriage of literature and technology.
A lot of people ask me about, you know, the gooey planet, and that is a ton of fun, yes, but it is still a rhyming story. It teaches them about words and rhythm, and it has a beginning, a middle, and an end.
It's all ahead on Lake Effect Weekend, but first the news. This is Lake Effect Weekend. From Milwaukee Public Radio, I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for joining us. Education dominates the first part of our news roundup this week, starting with a report that MPS students have again scored lower than most of the rest of the country on standardized math and reading tests. Then most of Wisconsin's teachers' unions voted to recertify, despite the now annual requirement that they do so. And there was also news of the large racial disparity in traffic stops by the Milwaukee police. Lake Effect Weekend's regular news analyst Bruce Murphy joins us now to put it all into perspective. Good afternoon, Bruce. It's great to see you.
Good afternoon.
We start right out with Milwaukee Public Schools this week. A new report found that Milwaukee Public School students had some of the lowest math and reading scores in the nation. Now, this is obviously not good news for the district or for the rest of us.
No, not good news at all. The results were from the respected National Assessment of Educational Progress tests. And they found that MPS fourth graders outperformed their peers in reading in just three districts, Cleveland, Fresno, and Detroit. MPS eighth graders scored ahead of just one of those cities in math and two of those cities in reading.
Well, this isn't the first time that the district has done poorly on these tests, is it?
No, the results were really similar in 2009, and really MPS has been doing poor on national scores, you know, compared to their national peers for some years.
Why? What are the theories on that?
I think what people don't understand is that when you take the Milwaukee Public School District, it's not comparable to other city districts because so many of the public school students in the city are actually going elsewhere. So you have students in choice schools, you have students in charter schools, you have them transferring to suburban schools under open enrollment, and you still have minority students transferring to suburban schools under the old Chapter 220 desegregation program. So a big chunk of city students are not represented in the Milwaukee public schools. And so what you have in MPS is a concentration of poor students and a concentration of special education students. And I think that has to have an impact on the scores.
So it's likely that we can expect that MPS scores will continue to remain at the bottom then if the demographics stay the way they are.
Well, the MPS officials aren't saying that. What they're saying is that these test scores were taken just around the time they set up their new system-wide reading program. So they have a whole new program, new curriculum that's standardized across the district. And they're very hopeful that this is going to have an impact on reading and that we'll see improvement in test scores to come. So we'll see.
Well, if there isn't improvement, what about this new bill that Governor Walker just signed on Wednesday that can allow student test scores to be used as a reason to fire a teacher? Are we looking at possibly citywide firings of MPS teachers because of test scores?
Well, I think that can certainly have an impact, not just in the city, but statewide. But, you know, I think MPS has a particularly difficult situation in terms of you're talking about teaching some of the hardest students to teach in the state. I wouldn't think just the performance on standardized test scores would ever be used to throw someone out of the job, but who knows? I mean, they certainly will have more flexibility to do so.
Another big story this last week, also related to education, the results of voting by teachers' unions showed that a large number voted to recertify.
Yes. Under the new law that was passed this year, union members have to vote to recertify their unions each year. Each year, they must sort of re-choose to be a union. And 177 of 266 unions voted to approve this. And I should note that under the law, you have to get a majority of all the members of the union, not just a majority of those who vote. And so that makes it much more difficult. I mean, in an average American election, say for president or governor, you never get a majority of all the people. You only get a majority of those who vote. So to get a majority of all the members, that makes it much tougher. And the fact that you had this high percentage of unions that were recertified, that's quite an endorsement of them by their union members.
So do you think this shows unions could maintain some of their power in the state?
Well, not necessarily. For starters, they're going to have to redo this every year, and that could become exhausting. But the other issue is that under the new law, union dues are no longer automatically deducted from your paycheck. The union dues have to be paid voluntarily by members, and some Republicans are already predicting that they're going to have trouble collecting dues.
Do you think they're right?
Well, the problem you have is one of the free rider. You're always going to have some people say, well, even if I like the union, why should I pay these dues? You get enough of those free riders, and then the others start to feel like they're suckers. So honestly, I think it's going to be difficult. They'll need to really work like heck to continue to try to sell people on continuing to pay the dues.
And they're going to have to do that every year.
Exactly.
Well, another big issue this week, a report by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel found a big disparity in traffic stops by the Milwaukee police. And I know this went all over Facebook. I saw this on Twitter. This has been out everywhere.
Yes, a lot of discussion of it. The research found that blacks were 7 times more likely to be stopped than whites, and Hispanics were 5 times more likely than whites to be stopped.
That does not sound good.
It doesn't. But I have to say, here's the curious thing. Even while the department has aggressively increased traffic stops, they've tripled under Chief Flynn, the number of complaints from citizens has gone down, and the NAACP has come out supporting what Flynn is doing.
Why? You'd think that they wouldn't. Why is the NAACP supporting him?
You'd think they'd be up in arms about these disproportionate numbers. But what's happening is that Flynn is aggressively targeting crime in minority neighborhoods. He's putting a lot of beat cops and bicycle cops on the street. They're getting to know the neighborhoods, trying to understand the crime patterns and clamp down on crime. I think people in these neighborhoods are feeling they're getting more help from police, more attention from police than they ever have before.
So the statistics can be looked at in a different way. You don't think the traffic stop data shows any problem then?
Well, I wouldn't go that far.
Okay. All right.
I think we know that there's racism in American society, and obviously the police aren't free from that. And, you know, I think there are undoubtedly examples of unjustified traffic stops and that fall too hard on minorities. But I still think there's a lot of good news for minorities in terms of how this department is conducting itself and how aggressively they're trying to combat crime in a way that hasn't been done before.
Well, last week also saw a change. This was sort of the end of an era, the death of Jean Lucey, the wife of former Governor Patrick Lucey. She was quite a character.
Yes, sometimes described as a fiery Greek. I remember doing a phone interview with Pat Lucey, and he had to finish some back and forth with his wife before he could get to my question. So they were known to argue.
She also said she was not a tea time dame, which I have to say I love that comment.
Yeah, it's a great one. I mean, basically she was saying, you know, she wasn't the sort of stand by her man, you know, that's kind of like Hillary Clinton said at one point. I mean, she did help on campaigns, but she was very outspoken. And one of the funny stories about her was that at one of the Democratic conventions back in Lucey's day, there were people wearing buttons with an acronym that stood for I've been called an SOB by Jean Lucey.
And they wore it with pride.
Well, I guess, or at least with a sense of humor.
Yeah. She was once quoted as saying, I was ahead of my time in a free spirit, and I guess reporters didn't expect that. And given the time that she was around, they probably didn't.
Well, yeah, I think that there, I do recall some stories that kind of made you wonder about her, but very fascinating person.
Absolutely. One of many that we talk about every week, Bruce Murphy. It is such a pleasure, and we'll catch up next week.
Thanks a lot, Bonnie.
Bruce Murphy is editor at Milwaukee Magazine, and he's Lake Effect Weekend's regular news analyst. Coming up next, how one woman's cells changed the course of medicine. We'll talk with the award-winning author of The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks when Lake Effect Weekend returns on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. We're back with more of Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Bonnie North. One of the most notorious breaches of medical ethics was uncovered in 1972 when it was learned that the U.S. Public Health Service let nearly 400 poor black men go untreated for syphilis in order to learn what happens to a person suffering from the disease. But the so-called Tuskegee experiment was only one example of a medical system that for a long time was racially biased and had few codified codes of ethics or consent laws. But not all of the examples were as overtly damaging as was Tuskegee's. One fairly simple collection of a tissue sample more than a half century ago had an enormous effect on medicine. Henrietta Lacks was a black woman living in Baltimore in 1951. She was dying of cervical cancer when doctors took a sample from the affected area, which changed the course of medical research. But members of her family never knew of the effect that Lacks' cells had or that the cells continued to live on in perpetuity until years later. And that discovery had a profound impact on the family's life as well. The story of Lacks' cells and her family are the subject of Rebecca Skloot's award-winning book, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke reached Rebecca Skloot by phone from Chicago, and she offered a brief primer about why Henrietta Lacks' cells differed from all the other tissue samples scientists had collected before.
Well, the big difference is that they survived and all the other ones died. So scientists had been trying to grow human cells outside the body for decades, and it had never worked. And no one knows exactly why that is. The difference between Henrietta's cells and all the others is still a little bit of a mystery, but her cells just never died. So they have been growing and dividing, doubling their numbers every 24 hours since 1951. And we know that she had syphilis, which can make cancer cells grow more rapidly, and she had HPV, which caused her cancer. So there's something about those viruses and her tissues that interacted together to make them grow the way they did.
It was really either the perfect storm or incredible serendipity that they happened to collect her cells and just from the right person and the right person that was doing the looking.
No, absolutely. It was a sort of perfect storm, you know, between the fact that of her cells being as powerful as they were, that she ended up at Hopkins, where the one scientist, George Guy, who was really the pioneer in all this stuff, had developed techniques that would make it possible to grow them. So it was the two of them coming together in that moment was pretty miraculous.
Well, I was hoping we could flash back to pretty early in the reporting process for you. The Lacks family was pretty reluctant to cooperate with you on telling the story. Why was it so compelling for you that you kept at it and jumped through the repeated hoops that were put in your path?
Well, you know, when I first learned about the cells, I was 16 in a basic biology class, and all I knew was that there were these incredible cells that had was really one of the most important things that happened to medicine. They came from a woman no one knew anything about, and she was black. Like, those are the only facts that I knew, and I just felt like I have to find out who she was and what her story was. I had no idea that her family had a story related to the cells. When I first started the book, I thought I was writing a book about the woman that the cells came from and the cells themselves. And my first contact with her daughter, it became very clear to me that something had happened to the family. So her children were actually used in research themselves in the 70s. No one told them that the cells were alive. She had five kids. No one told them until about 25 years after her death, when scientists came back to her kids and used them in research without their consent in order to learn more about the cells. And what followed was just literally decades of trauma for the family related to the cells. And my first phone call with her daughter, she didn't tell me what had happened, but she was so terrified to talk to me. And she kept saying, you know, she was excited about the idea of someone writing a book because then she could finally learn what these cells were and what they did for science, but that she didn't know who she could trust and maybe someone had sent me to take their cells. And none of it really made any sense to me. I didn't understand what she was talking about, but it was so clear that something had happened and that I needed to get to the bottom of why she was so reluctant to talk to me and that I would then understand the whole story. And that took about a year and a half to convince them to trust me and to talk to me.
And as became evident as you read this book, even once you earned their trust, yeah. it wasn't a consistent thing.
Right. Absolutely. And, you know, and I sort of understood that where they were coming from with that. You know, when I first called, I had no idea where I fit into the larger picture of their story. And really, I was just one in a long line of people, particularly white people, who'd come along wanting something from them having to do with these cells. And it had never worked out for them. And they had never personally benefited. You know, they had a lot of, no one had ever just sat down and explained to them even what a cell was. So they didn't have a lot of understanding of the science. And, you know, an enormous industry had grown out of these cells. People, you know, it was a multi-billion-dollar industry. Her kids still, you know, can't even afford health insurance. So there was a lot of anger, a lot of, you know, discrepancies in what they, just the facts of the story for them, but also in what they felt like they deserved and what they'd gotten. So, you know, and in the past they had trusted people who turned out to be there to really take advantage of them. And so, you know, for them, the story of their struggle to trust me is sort of part of the story of what happened to them because of these cells.
Well, one could not read that story without thinking of the term PTSD as we were reading
absolutely.
It.
Yeah.
One of the most interesting threads, obviously, that winds through the book is the evolution of informed consent laws. And I guess it would surprise people that they didn't really exist to any significant degree when Henrietta Lacks was a cancer patient in the early 50s. But it would probably surprise people even more that if she were a patient today, it's unclear what kind of consent they would need to take those cells today.
Right, yeah, absolutely. In the 50s, I mean, we didn't even have the term informed consent when Henrietta went to the hospital. So, yeah, taking her cells was standard practice, and they wouldn't have thought otherwise. Now, you know, obviously we have a lot of informed consent laws, but it's very it's very inconsistent how they apply to tissues. So if your identity is attached to your cells, that requires consent to take those and research on them. If they were taken specifically for research. But, you know, you go to the hospital, you get a biopsy, a blood sample that's for some other purpose, like a diagnostic test. And then those samples, as long as your name is removed, those are often stored and used in research and people don't know. So there is no requirement for consent as long as it's anonymous tissue. And there's no requirement, anonymous or not, about telling people their tissues may become profitable and that someone may, you know, make products using them or develop, you know, things that would become patented that would become valuable.
Well, and we should note one significant change has happened. The cells that came from Henrietta Lacks were essentially named for her, HeLa cells.
Right.
And science does not do that anymore.
Right, exactly. That's so they anonymize is what they call it, all tissues that they use. Even, you know, but some of them do have your identity attached in the records because your personal medical history is part of what's interesting to them about the cells. But for them to use that does require consent and a lot of really strict regulation about protecting privacy. But it's the other cells, the millions and millions of samples that are just sort of out there in biobanks. Those are completely anonymous. But, you know, your DNA is inside of them. And we already know that it's possible to find people from anonymous DNA samples. It's been done. It's not something that's done regularly. It's not something that's easy. But there's part of the story of the HeLa cells is in some senses about how science can change and how hard it is to predict what's going to be possible. You know, when they took Henrietta's cells, they didn't know what DNA was. So they didn't know they'd someday be able to look in her cells and learn about her family. They didn't know they'd someday be worth money. So we know now that it's possible to find people using anonymous samples. So what's going to be possible with those supposedly anonymous samples in 50 years? Who knows? So there's a lot of debate about whether anonymizing something even exists anymore.
Do you think is there something about this controversy that speaks to the kind of long simmering tension between science or scientists and non-scientists of even all races? I mean, at its heart, does science need to do a better job of justifying itself?
Yes, in some ways it is part of this much larger issue. And I think it's less about justifying itself and more about explaining itself. I think the story is so much about the importance of scientists being able to communicate science to the general public and about the general public being open to learning about science. So there's so much of the fear and controversy that surrounds science is more about not understanding than it is about not approving. And scientists aren't generally very good at explaining science to the public, and the public's not very good generally about sort of learning about it. So it's in some ways about the need for that, to bridge that gap more, which a lot of scientists are working very hard to do. It's also about, you know, I think the big area of mistrust that exists has to do with commercialization of science. And, you know, people are very, they want to know what's going on with their tissues. They want to know what's going on in science. And when they find out sort of after the fact that people are using their tissues they didn't know, especially if money's involved, then you get a lot of mistrust. And there's a lot of discussion about who should profit off science. And I think in a lot of ways that's more about our healthcare system than anything else. You know, the rationalization is everyone should, you know, donate tissues and because it helps science and everyone benefits from that and from commercializing because it encourages scientific progress. But in our country, not everyone does benefit. So you have people who donate tissues for research that's funded with tax dollars that's then turned into products that are sold back to people. Many of them can't afford it. So I think we'd see less of the controversy about money and commercialization if we had a different healthcare setup.
You write in several places in this book about the Lax family's spirituality and how it informed their ability to process Henrietta's immortal cells, and also how it contrasted with your own view of religion. Do you think you came out of the process of writing this book at all different from a spiritual level?
Oh, sure. I came out of this process different on probably every level. I was raised in a family that was not religious at all. I had no experience with much of religion, and Henrietta's family is very different. They believe very much that her soul is alive in these cells and that she was essentially brought back to life as an angel to take care of people. And, you know, as a science, you know, I have a science background, and in science we often talk about, you know, you hear about science versus religion and the ways that they are opposed to each other. And what I really saw with the Lax family was the ways that the science and religion can work together. You know, if it wasn't for their faith and their belief in her being brought back to life as an angel in these cells, it would have been very difficult and at points traumatizing for them to even really accept that these cells were still living. And, you know, so their faith really helped open them up to learning about the science of the cells and being okay with it. So I learned, you know, I saw a lot of that, but I also, you know, I read the Bible for the first time. I went to church. I was part of, you know, these faith healings and, you know, things that I'd never encountered. And people often ask if it converted me. You know, they say, have you been saved? And the answer is no. I did not change my personal religious beliefs, but it did really teach me a lot about the value of faith and the important role that it plays in people's lives and how positive it can be.
I will say it seemed like it took a certain amount of the word that comes to mind is guts to write about yourself so honestly in some of these scenes where you're clearly in this situation and feeling pretty uncomfortable with it.
Yeah. Well, and I resisted it for quite a long time. I did not have any intention of being in the book as a character. I teach writing, and I often harp on my students and say, you know, stop inserting yourself into other people's stories. And what I realized at a certain point was that I sort of had no choice but to be in the book because I was another character. I was another person who'd come along wanting something from them. I'd written about the other journalist who came along, and so in some ways I felt like it would have been dishonest to leave myself out. I also felt like it needed to be in there as a sense of disclosure about the relationship that I developed with Deborah and my own, you know, my own struggles with the family and their faith and everything else. So, yeah, it took me years to finally admit that I had to be in the book.
Well, Rebecca Skloot, thanks so much for taking some time with us and helping fill in some more of the story of Henrietta Lacks.
Yeah, thrilled to be there. Thank you.
Rebecca Skloot is the author of The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, published by Crown. Skloot lives in Chicago, and she spoke with Lake Effect's Mitch Teich by phone. Coming up next, a new novel by a local writer combines mysterious artifacts, possession, and yoga. A conversation with Mary Dally Munsmeyer is on Lake Effect Weekend next from WUWM. We'll be right back. We're back with more of Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Bonnie North, and it's great to have you with us. Milwaukee resident Mary Dally Munsmeyer has channeled her creativity into a lot of jobs, from sous chef to hairstylist, study abroad program coordinator to genealogical researcher, from blogger to her current position as communications coordinator at the Wisconsin Conservatory of Music. Well, she can now add novelists to her list. Dally Munsmeyer published her first novel, called Artifacts, in September. She drew on her varied interest in different cultures, history, and even yoga to craft the suspenseful mystery, which she set in an import shop. She tells Lake Effect's Stephanie Lecce why she chose this unusual setting.
The possibilities for the subject matter are just expansive. There's a lot of different ways that you can go with it, and it has an international aspect to it and a cultural aspect to it, which are some of my main interests. So that's why the import store was chosen as a topic.
When the story begins, we find Wally, the store owner, who's discovered his employee, Al, passed out on the ground. What's happened to her?
She doesn't really know, actually. And he doesn't know either. And it doesn't look like it was a robbery or anything like that. The cash register is still full. But yeah, she's passed out in the middle of the floor, and he helps to revive her. But it takes her a little while to figure out what exactly has happened to her.
Basically, she comes to remember that she had taken in this chest, which was left pretty much on the front doorstep. And before she knows it, there's a blinding light that comes from the chest, and that's about all she can remember at first.
Right, yeah. She does remember hauling it in. A woman had dropped it off in front of the store. And she hauls it in and looks it over, and it looks fine to her. So she goes to begin her practice of yoga. And while she's doing her introductory breathing exercises, there is suddenly a bright light.
Tell me about the importance of yoga and the philosophy behind it to the story.
Well, yoga is the meditative aspects of yoga kind of open you up to a lot of different psychological avenues, both in the real world and in terms of fiction. So the meditative state and the calmness of it, really the metaphor is opening up the mind to everything that the universe has to offer. And that's how she sees it, though she is very much a skeptic at heart. But yoga helps her to calm herself and open up her mind.
A skeptic until she has this experience with the chest.
Right.
How did you create the lore, if you will, behind this chest, where it came from, its mystical powers? Where did you find this myth?
Well, the chest is made of runo, which is kind of like bamboo, only it's stronger. And it comes from the Philippines. And the practice is pretty common in the Philippines to recycle materials. So that is an actual fact. The kind of mythological aspects to it, or the supernatural aspects to it, are obviously completely made up. But digging into indigenous beliefs, that kind of thing, you'll find that kind of aspect of entities or energies being trapped or housed in certain objects pretty common throughout indigenous belief systems. So that's basically where it came from. But I'm not saying that it's fact. It's it is a work of fiction. So
Al isn't the only person who's come in contact with it who's had this strange, overpowering experience.
Right. Yeah. The woman who had dropped off the chest in the first place, her husband had started to act very oddly and kind of sitting in front of the chest and chanting a word that his wife didn't understand. So the chest has proven itself to have effect on other people, but it's up to Al to kind of figure out what exactly is going on, both with the chest and with the individuals, who the other characters that step in to the story.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the relationship between Wally, the store owner, and Al. They have this really great banter between them, and they have a certain amount of chemistry and tension between them. How does this play into how much Wally reacts to what Al is telling him, especially some of this stuff, which honestly sounds a little crazy?
Yeah, and it sounds crazy to him, too. But his personality is one that he won't necessarily block off a form of thinking, even if he doesn't really believe that it's true. He has kind of a laissez-faire attitude towards life and a lot of other things. So his reactions to what's happening to her are, you know, really supportive but funny at the same time. And they go back and forth. There are a lot of relationships like that where you have a woman in her 20s or 30s or 40s who has a very strong connection to an older man or woman, could be a woman. But Wally happens to be, you know, a baby boomer. So he's mid-60s, maybe pushing 70. So he's had a lot of experience. But that relationship, I've had relationships like that with particularly older men, and Wally is a combination of those men. So those relationships interest me. It's basically an avenue to talk about different kinds of relationships, and particularly a relationship that's generationally bridging generations, but also bridging gender. So those kinds of relationships are really fascinating to me. And they happen quite a bit, and they're not necessarily talked about too much, I think, in our culture, but they exist.
Who are some of the other characters that we meet along the way? I know Jonas plays a pretty hefty role.
Yeah, Jonas and his brother Tobias. Jonas, he was a high-powered lawyer. He decided to leave his practice to open a community center in one of the tougher neighborhoods in town. And Al brings to him a drum. She's in a trance and, again, doesn't remember this until the next day. What happens to Jonas is he is kind of put in a trance state as well. And he is told that he should fly to Senegal. And that's where home is. So trying to figure out why Jonas went to Senegal, it's kind of like the second half of the novel that it deals with Jonas.
And what is the significance of this drum? You mentioned this idea of going home, which was also a theme with the chest as well. Why was this idea of going home important to you, especially as how it relates to objects themselves and maybe that energy that they have that you talked about before?
Well, for Al, she has what I like to call emotional artifacts. Emotional issues, things from her past that she hasn't dealt with before. And technically, she doesn't have a home. So wrapping that metaphor up into artifacts that have been imported from countries, ending up where they shouldn't be, really, that is a part of the whole theme of going home and being in the right place, which goes back kind of to the relationship between Al and Wally. And there being a sense of home there. His support of her is unwavering, even though he might doubt some of the things that she says. So it's an overall theme to the novel.
Why did you want to explore this theme of home, these relationships, and even these emotional artifacts that you mentioned?
Well, I think in the modern world, we have a little bit of difficulty trying to create home. We spend a lot of time away from home and away from the people who are really important to us. So that kind of a theme, I think, rings and speaks to a lot of people when they are trying to navigate the complexities of their lives. They have a trouble feeling at home or knowing where home is. So those kind of questions, I think, are important to the kind of modern industrialized lives that we lead.
Now, Al is a former PR representative, and I know that that is something that you have worked in.
Yes.
And I wanted to ask how much of the inspiration for Al is autobiographical and how much is just pure fiction and the writer's exercise of creativity?
Well, you know, I actually enjoy doing marketing and public relations quite a bit. I mean, I have never worked in a corporate setting. So I've kind of gone out of my way to avoid that setting altogether and worked in very small businesses. And right now I work for a nonprofit, the Wisconsin Conservatory of Music. And I do really enjoy the work, but there are a lot of contradictions that exist in that. And if you're a conscious person, what your effect is on the culture that you live in, that can be a lot of conflict within yourself. There's a lot of, shall we say, fakeness in some of the marketing and PR field. So trying to balance that with your understanding of ethics, that's something that I wanted to talk about. The settings that she works in and or had worked in and the settings that I work in are different, but there are still those contradictions that kind of come up.
Is this why you turned to writing, to kind of have a creative outlet to explore some of these issues, this being your first novel?
Yeah, I've been writing for a very long time, and writing has always been a way for me to try to work out the inherent contradictions of life. It can be a very confusing world, and it can be very confusing internally as well. So writing is, amongst other artistic expressions, is a good way for me and for everyone out there to explore those conflicts and contradictions and the joys and the struggles that we have in life.
Now, will we see Wally and Al again?
I'm thinking about it. You know, those are two characters that I like spending time with. And as I said before, the subject matter of being in an import shop just has kind of unlimited possibilities. You can go anywhere with that. So, yeah, I would be interested in writing a sequel.
Great. Well, Mary, thanks so much for coming in and speaking with us today.
Thank you very much, Seth.
Mary Dally Muntzmeyer's debut novel is called Artifacts. It's published by Cerebral Benz Productions. That's a creative services company Dally Muntzmeyer launched in 2003 with her husband. She's also the communications coordinator at the Wisconsin Conservatory of Music, and she blogs about Wisconsin art and culture at Cricket Toes. She spoke with Stephanie Lecce. It's the marriage of literature and technology next when we hear about an interactive kids book application for the iPad. We'll meet the author and illustrator when Lake Effect Weekend returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Welcome back. You're listening to Lake Effect Weekend on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. When a children's book has been illustrated well, it's almost like the story pops off the page. In the time of electronic and interactive books, this phrase is becoming ever more literal. Astro Jammies is a case in point. First published as an interactive children's book for the iPad, Astro Jammies lets kids squish, bounce, and twirl planets, stars, and more as they follow the tale of protagonist Jimmy's journey through outer space. Author and illustrator Stacey Williams-Ung worked alongside publishing technology company DemiBooks to create this interactive book application. And its success as a book app has led to its launch as a traditional hardcover that includes some brand new illustrations. We first spoke with Williams-Ung in February when she told Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce about the then just launched app.
Astro Jammies is the story of a little boy named Jimmy. He's painted to look as if he's about 5 years old, and it is the classical tale of a child who has a fantasy of getting away from his real life, going into a fantasy world, and then, of course, getting frightened and deciding he wants to come home, not unlike Wizard of Oz or many other famous children's stories. Mine is targeted toward younger children, and it's his fantasy place is outer space.
And his jammies take him there.
And his jammies are magical, and they, along with his imagination, take him into outer space. That's right.
Now, you not only wrote this story, you also illustrated the story as well, correct?
That's right.
And tell me a little bit about the illustrations. They're almost Van Gogh-like once he's out in outer space.
Right. I tried not to do the Starry, Starry Night when I was doing the paintings. I forcibly tried not to do that. But it's very hard. I went and looked at visual references for outer space to inspire my paintings. And it is a swirly, swirly place. And I couldn't help getting caught up in the idea of painting with these big brush strokes. And I've had several people compare it to Starry, Starry Night. And I keep thinking, stop that. I was really trying not to do that. But
Well, now, the really awesome thing about Astro Jammies is that it's actually been designed to be an interactive book. Can you tell me about how you got involved in making Astro Jammies into an interactive book designed for the iPad and other tablet devices?
Sure. I had an idea for a children's book, like many artists do. I still have several ideas for children's books, of course, and they were just sitting on a shelf, languishing. And a friend of mine that I used to work with in the interactive industry when I was a creative director, he remembered my artwork. He remembered my illustrations. And he knows I have a lot of creative friends. And so he and some other colleagues have recently started a publishing company called Demibooks, specifically for iPad and maybe in the future for things like Android and, as you said, other devices. But for now, they're starting with the iPad. And he approached me and said, essentially, do you or any of your friends have any ideas for children's books to help us get this thing off the ground? And I said, of course, well, I do. And Astro Jammies was not titled yet, but what I was thinking of as the boy who goes into outer space with his jammies was my favorite idea. And I thought it had the most potential being a fantasy story for special effects. If they were going to offer, you know, things that went boing and things, you know, a rocket that can launch and all these wonderful things, of my ideas, this one seemed to be the one with the most vitality.
Well, so take us through some of these interactive features. What can kids do as they're reading the book?
Sure. Well, for example, in the same way that many children in fantasy stories have a way that they get to their fantasy world. You know, I remember when I was a kid, when my kids were younger and they'd watch Dragon Tales, the kids, I think, had to get into a magic box or something. And Dorothy had to click her heels 3 times. And I knew that Jimmy was going to have a ritual in order to get himself into outer space. And so we thought about something as simple as spinning around. So I shared this with the programming team and said, I'd like him to spin around in order to get himself into outer space. And they said, well, we can actually do a 360-degree turn of an object. And I said, well, that sounds perfect. So basically with the swipe of a finger, because the iPad is a touch screen, children see Jimmy and they read the story that, you know, he spun himself 3 times. And so they can use their finger to spin him around in either direction, which is really kind of above and beyond what I had hoped. But it's got momentum and it's really a fun and satisfying thing to do, to use your finger and push him around and around.
There's also a point in the story where Jimmy's out in outer space and he's exploring and he comes across a planet made of goo. And
yes.
I really like that page.
That's also my favorite page. I wanted outer space to be a silly place. I didn't want it to be a heavy-handed lesson about what outer space is like because, of course, we're in a young boy's imagination. So he encounters funny things in outer space. And one of them, that's right, is a big planet. I would even say a snotty planet. It's green and it's slimy. And he, of course, thinks it's going to be fresh green grass, but when he gets closer, he realizes, oh, gosh, you know, this is a planet full of goo. So in my imagination, I was trying to imagine, you know, I did certainly want a crazy sound effect, like a, I would even say a farty sound effect. And we did find that, but the programming team went above and beyond, and they were able to create this effect that they called dough poke.
Okay.
If you think of like the Pillsbury Doughboy, and basically when your finger touches the screen, the object seems to give. It seems to give under your finger. And so this planet that I painted, it's just a flat painting. When you put a light bulb behind it, it seems to glow with luminescent goo. And also when you touch it, it seems to give beneath your finger as though it's made of gel. And I can't tell you how happy I am with this effect.
And can we hear the noise?
Sure. So when you touch this planet, it sounds... has a wonderfully satisfying gross effect that I can tell you, I've decided my target audience, my perfect target audience is 7-year-olds. Although we say 3 to 8, it is the 7-year-old that will laugh hysterically every single time that sound effect is played.
Oh, I'm sure. Now, there's another really cool page where Jimmy comes across a lot of different planets all in the same space. And this page has been programmed that each of the planets have their own chord.
That's right. My original idea, if you listen to the narrative, it is a rhyming story. So this page says, "Old Jupiter had many moons. Jimmy looked at them all afternoon. He chose the one that seemed the best, with hills so soft for sleep and rest." So here's Jimmy, and he has come across a whole series of moons, and he's supposed to, along with his reader helper, who, you know, is your child, right, is supposed to help him choose the best moon. And so I knew that I wanted visually a page full of different colored moons. We have like pale green and pale blue, all these different moons. But immediately, because the iPad can sense your motion, they start bouncing around. So they're sort of like bouncy balls. And each of these balls has been programmed with a keyboard sound, a keyboard note. And so if you play each one, or when they bounce into one another, they make these wonderful musical sounds. But you can also play multiple ones to make chords.
You can play a little moon symphony there.
You sort of play a moon symphony, that's right. So in a way, the interaction, and in all children's books, all the best children's books do this. I mean, even though obviously most of them are not interactive. And the best ones, the illustrations are so distracting that they tell a story that is almost on a separate plane than the story itself. And I think that's what defines the best children's books, is where the illustration is adding so much more to the story. And so I had a special opportunity here with interactivity that I could add sound and, you know, motion and all that sort of thing. So it's been really great.
Now, as the author, how much of an influence did you have working with the DemiBooks team to create the different interactive features? I mean, how involved were you in that process?
Well, I had the opportunity to be completely the creative director on every level, to say, I want this to happen, or I don't like the way, you know, Jimmy floats in this scene. He should be more weightless. And they would, you know, do my bidding. They were great. But on another level, I was really blessed to have a set of programmers that had some really great insights. So, for example, they would come back with suggestions for me that added to the story. And I almost felt like I couldn't take full credit after that, because they gave such wonderful insights. For example, the music we just talked about was not my idea. My original idea was to touch the moons, and they each maybe had a silly sound effect. But a fellow named Christopher Rosen on our team, he came back. He's a musician. And he came back and said, "I would love it if they had this musical effect. What do you think of my idea?" And I said, "I think it's a genius idea." And in another example, there were visual suggestions. Another programmer by the name of Andrew Skinner, he had the idea of making the sun pulse with heat and light when Jimmy flies by it. Instead of just being a painting that looks hot, why don't we animate it and make it pulse with heat? And I thought, well, that's a really delicate and elegant solution for how to make it just that much more beautiful, you know, and so I said, yeah, let's go for it.
And besides the visual components, there's also original music to the book as well, correct?
That's right. I'm blessed to have a friend named Steve Dixon, who's a fantastic musician and works for a record company. And I asked him if he would just do a simple little ditty for the opening so we could have some original music. And he went way above and beyond the call of duty, and he did this beautiful opening music. I just feel like this song is so full of hope and imagination that
and
it
wonder.
Just yeah, and wonder. It really captures what a little boy full of hope and imagination, you know, feels. And I just thought that he really went above and beyond on this song.
Now, let me ask, you know, it's interesting because kids today are, you know, there's so many other things vying for their attention, video games, television, internet. And yet with this kind of an interactive book, it seems like a good way to draw kids back into reading while giving them those kinds of interactive elements that they're used to in the other activities that they give their time and attention to.
It's true. And philosophically, I've given this a lot of thought because, you know, I've been dreaming for a long time about doing children's literature, but I never expected to enter it this way. And I've had to examine my own feelings about it. And, you know, I'm obviously a huge fan of interactive. I was a creative director for websites and other, you know, and software for many years. And so that's where I come from. And I know what children's expectations are in this generation, being a mother too. So they have very high expectations of what something that's interactive should do. If they touch something and it doesn't wiggle, they're angry because they have such high expectations. So it's a tough crowd, let me tell you. But I thought it was very important to not make this a video game. And that was one thing I liked about Demi Books and the team. Philosophically, they met with my same demands, which were this still needs to be a book. It still needs to have literary quality at the level of our reading audience, which is, you know, ages 3 to 8. But I still wanted there to be a reason for them to be reading it, something that engages them, something that excites them about reading. That the fundamental part of this story, a lot of people ask me about, you know, the gooey planet and all of that. And that is a ton of fun, yes. But it is still a rhyming story. It teaches them about words and rhythm and it has a beginning, a middle, and an end, and it has pages. So it is still a book, and I truly believe that. And I think it would be just as successful in print as it is an interactive book.
Well, Stacey Williams-Long, thank you so much for coming in and telling us and showing us a little bit of what Astro Jammies can do.
Thanks, Stephanie.
Stacey Williams-Ung is the author and illustrator of the interactive children's book Astro Jammies, which is now available as a hardcover print book. It was first published as a book app for the iPad by Chicago-based Demi Books, where Williams-Ung is now creative director. You can find the book in the iPad App Store, as well as a free version called Astro Jammies Lite. The music bumps we've heard are two versions of the Astro Jammies theme written by Steve Dixon. Williams-Ung first spoke with Stephanie Lecce in February. She'll be launching the hardcover Astro Jammies and talking about publishing book apps at Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee on Thursday the 15th. You can find more information at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. And that's all the time we have for Lake Effect Weekend. We're here every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4 in the afternoon. Be sure to tune into our weekday version of Lake Effect as well. All next week, it's Project Milwaukee, State of Upheaval. We'll take stock of what the year in politics has meant, examine the circumstances that led us to last year's elections, look at how the landscape in both the public and private sector has changed, and consider which issues loom on the horizon. We'll also ask what Wisconsin might have looked like today if the past year had gone differently. Project Milwaukee, State of Upheaval begins Monday morning on WUWM-FM and HD1, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for listening. Stay right here for Weekend All Things Considered, coming up next.